Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hello and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, I'm not a woman, I'm not a man, I am something that you'll never understand. I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and our regular host Jonathan Strickland is not with us this week. He is off running around somewhere in Europe doing who knows what.
I certainly don't know.
But in Jonathan's place today, we are joined by our excellent co-worker, Raquel. Raquel, could you please introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. My name is Raquel Willis. I am a digital publisher here at HowStuffWorks.com, and I'm also a writer and activist.
We wanted to invite Raquel onto the show today because we are talking, if you perhaps cottoned on to our Prince lyric, about the future of gender. And this is a topic that we had a listener request for, and so I kind of wanted to read this email. It is from Gemma. She says, hi, and then said something really nice about us that I'm not going to repeat because it's embarrassing. I am delighted to say that you guys have helped influence my decision to study artificial intelligence at university next year and to further do research in the field. As well as being excited about the technology, I try to think of how larger social issues will be dealt with in the future, such as what impact computers and AI could have on developing countries, possibly largely through education, and if capitalism will ever crumble, a bit like the politics you talked about in the Star Trek Economy episode.
Oh, yeah, that one.
Yeah, that's one of the fan favorites, I think.
Yeah, we hear about that a lot.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Gemma says, I try to fight against all kinds of inequalities and am an enthusiastic feminist, us too. There are some interesting ideas about the future of gender specifically, such as gender neutrality and post-genderism linked with transhumanism. I think it'd be really awesome if you guys could touch on some of these ideas sometime or just look into it. Thanks for your time and awesomeness. And then there's a really cool, cute little emoticon thing.
Well, thank you, Gemma, because I think that is a really interesting idea to talk about on this show. It's a fascinating topic to look at because it occurs at the intersection of a bunch of different things that we do talk about a lot and touches all of them kind of equally. It includes biology, technology, and culture. And now there's obviously no way we can come even close to saying everything there is to say about a concept as huge and important as gender.
Oh, yeah. We already delayed recording this podcast once because we were like, oh, we have too many things to say for this to occur today.
Yeah, but I think one thing that we can try to do is just look at a few indications of trends in how humans have been understanding gender, especially in our culture here in the West, and how those trends might continue into the future, and then touch on Gemma's idea of post-genderism toward the end, which is a really interesting concept that, frankly, I think we should have explored on this show sometime before, given all the ways it interacts with topics we talk about all the time, like transhumanism.
Well, there's a lot of future out there, Joe, and we only have 2 episodes a week.
That's true.
I did want to put in here that, of course, gender doesn't exist in a vacuum. I mean, by necessity, because it's a cultural and social construct. So like Joe said, and kind of in the interests of our heads not exploding totally, we're going to be talking mainly today about gender in the West and in the United States specifically. And we're going to be speaking in some generalized terms, but of course, keep in mind that, you know, the United States is a multicultural society and gender interconnects with like race and religious beliefs and all of these other big, huge factors that certainly cannot be ignored, but we might be glossing over a tiny bit. But hey, speaking of generalized terms, let's lay out some definitions because there seems to be some confusion sometimes when people are talking about the terms sex and gender, and as a side note, sexuality.
Mm-hmm. So, yes, so we're going to start off with some generalized terms, just kind of breaking it down for you guys a little bit. These are concepts that we live with throughout our entire lives, but of course, unless you really, really have to, you might not look at them too closely.
Yeah.
So starting with sex. So sex is generally what we think of biologically wise. It's what's going on with your body. So you may have always heard that sex is binary, right? It's male versus female. But of course, we know with the rise of genetics and the study of hormones and chromosomes and all these different sex therapies that there's a range. There's male, female, intersex, and actually you can change your sex.
Absolutely.
Then we'll get into gender. So gender is socialized. It's kind of the personalized version of your sex and how you present to the world, right? So going back to that binary, that's a little iffy because not everyone identifies as masculine or feminine or either one of those in a strict sense. You can transcend gender, right? You can be anywhere on what we consider a continuum or the gender spectrum. And then just as a side note, a lot of times people conflate sexuality with your biological sex or with your gender, but these are all really independent factors. So if you want to break it down, you can kind of think of it as, you know, sex is basically what you are assigned with at birth or what you are set to be born as. Gender is often how you feel. It's what you go to bed as. And sex and sexuality can be thought of as who you may want to go to bed with.
That's a good way of putting it.
Absolutely. And historically, all of these definitions have kind of slid and changed. The concepts of sex and gender are not solid as much as kind of like tradition dictates that they have to have been this way all of the time. They haven't been. Certainly the medical definition has changed a whole lot in the past 100 years or so. It wasn't until the 1890s that humanity first started figuring out that there are chromosomes, that chromosomes exist. Chromosomes, of course, being the winded-up bits of DNA that help determine your biological sex. There was a German biologist by the name of Hermann Henking who was studying sperm formation in wasps, you know, like you do.
I often do that.
And he noticed that some of the sperm cells had 11 chromosomes while others had 12. He called this extra chromosome the X element, hence eventually X chromosomes, the X element, and hypothesized that it had to do with sex determination. His hypothesis was then later supported by two American zoologists who were working with grasshoppers around 1902. Not sure why it was all insects. But anyway, it was eventually the subject of one paper that I read caused a lively debate for a few years.
Uh-huh.
I'm not positive what in like Victorian-ish times like lively debate precisely means, but I'm delighted by that. Prior to these studies, though, it was thought that environmental factors determined the sex of an embryo.
Oh, like if it gets warm while the embryo is developing or something.
Exactly, yeah. And eventually we realized that there are a number of chromosomal conditions in humans, not just XX and XY, but extra X's or Y's can be present, or a single X can exist all on its own. And that's the intersex category that Raquel was talking about a second ago. And estimates of the rate of intersexuality in the population range from like 0.02% to about 1.7%, depending on exactly how you define it.
Yeah.
So biologically speaking, there are not just dudes and ladies. Like that's not what's up.
And just the fun fact, you cannot always just assume what your chromosomes are. You know,
there are
a lot of different factors that can go into your chromosomal makeup, and you really can only know if you get tested.
Exactly.
Yeah,
totally.
I've read stories about that where people.
Your phenotype, what your genes have produced in your body doesn't necessarily make a difference or doesn't necessarily indicate that you have an XX or an XY.
Yeah.
Right.
And it happened to be around the same time that that researchers began realizing the roles that hormones play in our bodies, too. There was some animal research in the mid-1800s establishing the idea that organs in the body can communicate with each other via chemicals, like communicate in like big hilarious 1800s scare quotes. and then we got the word hormone. It was coined in 1905, and of course, you know, since then we've been able to synthesize hormones in the lab and develop hormone therapies to help people who were either born with a genetic disorder. I mean, also technically, like insulin is a hormone, so that's pretty great that we can synthesize that in labs. Mm-hmm. Or of course, people who are choosing to change their bodies with hormone therapy. So we've come a long way, but we're really still figuring out how individuals' bodies regulate their own hormones, and furthermore, how those hormones interact with other bodily processes.
Yeah, and so that's getting us closer to where we are today in terms of our understanding of biological sex and intersex conditions. But there's also a sort of cultural history that we should look at terms of received ideas about gender. Because with this distinction we made earlier, sex is biology, gender is identity, and identity involves culture, values, norms, expectations, behaviors. And so I guess we should look at how those things have changed in the past. I think a lot of people would just assume that, you know, the traditional position as they would see it in the West in the 20th century or something like that has always been the case everywhere. Well, we just always believed that there are men and women and that men should be masculine and women should be feminine.
And that the definitions of masculine and feminine have been the same.
Yeah, but it hasn't always been that way everywhere.
So, yes, many of the world's cultures historically and even today recognize more than just two genders. The idea of a male or female role as the only options really is, in a lot of ways, very, let's just say a lot of cultures have been very creative. So even here in the United States, if we think historically, among Native Americans, the role or the idea of a third, fourth, or fifth gender, often called Two-Spirit, has been widely documented. Children who may have been born physically male or female but showed an interest or a proclivity for another gender role within their societies were often encouraged to live out those gender roles and see what fit them best. So, you know, when you think about these roles and how they were regarded within a lot of Native American cultures, we won't say all, these roles were given a lot of respect, and they were often thought of as very spiritually powerful. So people who were Two-Spirit were often shamans and teachers and caretakers. And it's very important to remember that there are many Two-Spirit identified people around today. And of course, there are many cultures still throughout the world who view gender in a different way than we do here in the United States.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And the history, I mean, like we could do an entire ridiculously long episode about the changes in this kind of cultural perspective that have happened over the past few centuries, let alone the past few millennia. And that it's really interesting, and that's not what we got into today. But what we did get into is some of the modern attitudes and definitions that we ascribe to gender and sex here in the United States, like legally and culturally speaking.
Yeah, that's right, because I think looking at law is a good way to sort of get a gauge for the level of acceptance something is encountering in the society at large. So, you know, how does the law treat gender? Does the law even recognize this idea of gender identity as something different than just what genitalia you have or what sex chromosomes you have? And in U.S. law, traditionally, the answer was mostly no, until more recently, that there was a sex distinction in the law. Any laws that pertain to how men and women should be treated or treated differently or not treated differently just were trying to use biological distinctions as understood at the time.
Mm-hmm. AKA the binary.
Yeah, exactly. They were reverting to the biological binary as they understood it. For example, in U.S. law, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 prohibits, among other things, employment discrimination on the basis of sex. So you're not supposed to, under this law, hire a man when there's, you know, a more qualified woman that really you should be hiring, but you just would rather have a man working for you.
Right.
So traditionally, this was interpreted by U.S. courts to refer to biological sex, not gender identity. But this is changing, and through the accumulation of many changes in law and judicial interpretation over time. So I want to talk about one example I read about. In 2012, the Federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, or the EEOC, set this important precedent relating to the legal status of gender identity in a case called Macy versus Holder. and the Holder was Eric Holder, the Attorney General.
So okay. Oh, okay.
Suit being brought to the government about gender discrimination. And so the plaintiff was a police detective. She was a ballistics expert who applied for a job at a crime lab while still presenting as male. And she seems to have been offered the job pending a background check. But then after she announced a change in her listed name and gender, the tentative job offer was retracted. And then she reported receiving contradictory explanations for why this happened. One person told her budget cuts eliminated the position. And a different person told her, you know, well, we went with a different candidate who was farther along in the process, according to the plaintiff. And in the end, the EEOC ruled that Title VII should apply to gender identity. That was one of the things that was taken away from the ruling in this case. So they wrote, quote, if Title VII prescribed only discrimination on the basis of biological sex, then only prohibited gender-based disparate treatment would be when an employer prefers a man over a woman or vice versa. But the statute's protections sweep far broader than that, in part because the term gender encompasses not only a person's biological sex, but also the cultural and social aspects associated with masculinity and femininity. And so, this is one legal precedent for understanding there's a distinction here and sort of recognizing that distinction. And of course, when courts recognize the distinction, it begins to gain a level of leverage essentially over what can be done with the law in the society. And some jurisdictions have actually tried to put gender identity into specific terms so that, for example, it can be demonstrated in the court in the case of, for example, an employment discrimination suit on the basis of gender identity. Just one example is a 2011 Massachusetts state law that tried to offer one of these definitions, and it said, quote, gender-related identity may be shown by providing evidence including but not limited to medical history, care or treatment of the gender-related identity, consistent and uniform assertion of the gender-related identity, or any other evidence that the gender-related identity is sincerely held as part of the person's core identity.
Which seems reasonable.
Yeah. So I think legal definitions like this provide sort of like additional bricks in the edifice of mainstream acceptance of the idea of gender identity as something distinct from biological sex, and thus something that could contribute to this post-gender idea that we're going to talk about eventually here.
Yeah.
Right. So one of the reasons, or one of the main reasons, that gender identity is kind of this term that we needed to describe our experiences with gender is that there are so many people who may not identify with the gender that they were assigned at birth, right? So we often think of people who may be transitioning from a male gender to a female gender or vice versa, but of course there are many ways in which people can kind of transcend gender. People can identify with gender on the spectrum or off of the spectrum, in the middle of the spectrum, on different ends of the spectrum. There are so many different ways to identify, and we often associate this with transgender people. And so there actually is a report that came out in 2011 from the Williams Institute in California that estimated that there are about 700,000 transgender Americans. I would dare to say that there are many, many more.
Yeah, that number sounds low to me.
Right, it does.
I mean, but maybe I'm also including in my like mental calculation non-gendered people, like people who do feel that they fall outside of the spectrum and aren't necessarily and are living just however they want to, but wouldn't necessarily identify as trans.
Right. And I would imagine, you know, since 2011, there's been such an uptick in visibility and just understanding. I mean, there are new ways in which people describe themselves within the transgender community. So there's definitely got to be more out there. but going into recognition, right? So it's important that people can get that legal recognition of how they identify. And so one of the things we're seeing lately is an expansion of legal gender definitions and options. Recently, an Oregon court ruled in favor of a person identifying as neither sex option or a traditional sex option or a traditional gender option, and so that they can really assert their identity as a non-binary individual. And so historically, Oregon law, it didn't necessarily specifically limit gender options to male or female, but that was kind of the unspoken idea or rule.
It was like the checkbox, like you're
right.
That thing or you're that other thing, and that's your options.
Yeah. Right. When rules are unspoken, people sort of default to their prejudices, I suppose.
Yeah.
Right. And then, of course, so for decades, that legal process really only involved this idea of changing from one sex to another or changing from one gender to another. And so that process really was very much like changing a name. You know, you submitted papers and a petition, and the petitioner would submit that paperwork. You would pay a filing fee and then, you know, get a notice of your proposed change. And so this judge in particular was like, okay, you know, you've got all the paperwork here. If this is how you identify, then this is valid. And so this is really one of the first cases within the United States of legal representation of people who don't identify as strictly male or strictly female. And, of course, there are other countries around the world that have kind of tackled this issue or have some kind of built-in mechanism legally that encompasses people who identify with a gender that isn't just male or female, places like Singapore, Nepal, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and then, of course, there are other places like Australia and Germany that have stipulations on intersex children or people who are born as intersex identifying in different ways.
Right. So there really does seem to be a trend towards more recognition of gender as a separate category from sex and of non-binary sex identification in a legal framework. And it doesn't mean that there's not resistance to this trend. It's obviously no surprise that people have lots of opinions about gender and how things are supposed to be when it comes to sex and sex-related concepts. But
I have noticed that on the internet once or twice.
Yeah, so fairly stated, we all know that people have opinions. But I would say from as close to we can get as a point of neutral observation, it does seem undeniable that in the United States, things are changing.
Right.
The law is moving toward a more general recognition of gender identity as a category separate from sex and a potentially protected class under laws like the 64 Civil Rights Act. Just one more example. In an article for the American Bar Association, which mentions the things that I was talking about the last time I spoke and more, Evan Schlack predicts that this trend of increasing legal recognition for gender identity will continue into the future. And to illustrate the sort of single directionality of the trend, he points out that only 3 states recognized and prohibited employer discrimination based on gender identity between 1993 and 2003, but that expanded to 13 states plus the District of Columbia during the next 10-year period up to 2013. So that does seem like a pretty strong trend we can observe there. And the trend, of course, in law is mirrored in culture at large as something that's probably less strictly codified and enforceable, but you can kind of get a gist of generally how gender is perceived among in movies and on TV and what people talk about on the internet. Right?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, all of that that fascinating pop culture stuff.
Yes, yes. So getting out of the kind of nitty gritty legal world, we're gonna step into culture. And if you're like everyone in the world and you follow some kind of entertainment and media, there has always kind of been this playground of gender expression.
Yeah.
You can think about who a lot of people consider this kind of gender nonconformity goddess, Grace Jones.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can think of the late David Bowie. And, of course, the also very, very recently late Prince.
Oh.
But more recently, there have been a lot of young male celebrities like Will Smith's son, Jaden Smith, and Magic Johnson's son, EJ Johnson, pushing the envelope for a new generation with closets that are a bit more unabashedly feminine. And then, of course, women have transcended gender in fashion for a long time. I mean, you can just think of days long ago when women could not wear pants. And of course, women wear pants all the time. We have someone running for president who always wears pants for the most part.
Yeah, we are both wearing pants right now.
We are.
No way.
It's true, Joe. It's all true.
Pants for everyone. To support it.
Or not, you know, or whatever you want. Yeah. Yeah. And it's a little bit more accepted, I think, or it's been more acceptable in women. So it's kind of exciting to see, men having the opportunity to do that as well. But yeah, there's been, certainly in high fashion for a long time, this trend towards breaking those rules.
Right. Definitely. Yeah, breaking the rules is all the rage in fashion world. And, of course, androgynous models have been in vogue at various points. However, there's been a reluctance for a long time to actually feature models that may really identify outside of the bounds of a binary gender.
Oh, right. People who weren't, like playing in with it, but were serious about it.
Right. Right. Yeah. So not just necessarily a woman breaking norms in a suit, or a man breaking norms in a skirt, but actually people who identify outside of the binary. So within the past 10 years or so, maybe more, I guess maybe a bit more, there's been an increase or interest in gender variant and transgender models. So in 2008, there was a model on America's Next Top Model, of course, Tyra Banks' masterpiece. And her name is Isis King. She kind of became a household name and really gave a face and a start to trans models in a mainstream sense. And then we can kind of flash forward to now, almost a decade later, and there are so many other trans models covering magazines all the time. People like Andreja Pejic, who really kind of transitioned in front of the fashion world from really an androgynous model before to now, like, claiming her identity as a woman. And then Leah T, Aiden Dowling was on the cover of Men's Health, a trans man. And then Laith Ashley and some other models. There's actually a transgender model agency in New York.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, it opened a few months ago. So we're really seeing this continuing trend even in culture. And then as well with some specifically gender-neutral fashion lines, there's also been this huge emergence. There are some lines like Vaquera, Tillian William, Claire Barrow, and 69, amongst so many other gender-neutral fashion lines. But, of course, it doesn't seem that culture as a whole is going gender neutral, right? Not everyone's going around wearing nondescript gender clothing, but it's kind of undeniable that the options for men, women, and folks who may identify otherwise are kind of expanding respectively.
And that the cultural acceptance of wearing those kind of clothes out about in the world is expanding. It's still, I mean, depending on what area you live in, absolutely. We're very lucky here in Atlanta, I think, to have a very diverse community who is comfortable and accepting of people's self-expression.
Yeah, I think that's true about our city. It's funny how I, for some reason, my brain did not even go to this place when I was thinking about this episode. It did not even cross my mind to think about clothing as such a fundamentally gendered part of our everyday experience.
Oh yeah,
it's a language.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We had Holly on a few months to a year ago to talk about the future of fashion, and yeah, it's such. It's crazy, especially when I think we decided during that episode that Joe is of the, like, what can I wear to be the least obtrusive, visually speaking, in the world. And Holly and I were like, more sequins on everything. or you know, for sometimes. And so, yeah, it's very, very much a thing that I certainly think about, like, every day. Like, how am I going to be perceived as a lady human when I put this particular outfit on?
Huh. I mean, I worry about how I'll look, but I guess...
I mean, which is also part of that, like, unfortunate gender binary oppression. I know oppression is a strong word, but I'm kind of being serious. Like it's a very interesting thing where like the amount of policing that we do of how men are supposed to look versus how women are supposed to look.
Well, I'm okay to live in that future where everybody wears identical jumpsuits. That'd be okay with me. But,
just like white jumpsuits with metallic embellishments.
That's the expression. You can pick a color. Everybody's got identical jumpsuits, and you can pick, you know, I want a green one.
And you just have to wear that color all the time?
No, you can wear whatever color you want.
Can I pick sequin colors to go on the jumpsuits?
I'm sorry. I would never force anybody else to wear a jumpsuit.
So, the future of gender may not be jumpsuits, but we do have a discussion about what it might look like and what some people are theorizing.
Yeah, because so everything we've talked about now kind of gets us up to now, right? So there are these trends in legal recognition and ideas about gender there. There are trends in what's accepted culturally, but in the future, how much could these things change? And here's where we want to come to the futurology concept of post-genderism, which our listener Gemma brought up in the email she sent us. I think this is a really interesting concept, and I didn't know that much about it before I started doing the research for this episode, but I think maybe I'm a post-genderist now. I think maybe I'm convinced by the arguments.
I think I didn't have a word to put on my opinions before, but I think this absolutely sums up how I feel about stuff. we should at this point put in a hat tip to a really useful overview of the topic.
Yeah, it was a paper I found published through the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies in 2008. It was called Postgenderism Beyond the Gender Binary by George Dvorsky and James Hughes. And it essentially just tried to, in a very tight space, condense a lot of historical and cultural and technological trends that have led up to where we are with gender now and how technology might be changing that.
So if you guys are if your appetite is whetted by this conversation, then maybe go check out that article and go through its source list, because there's a lot of really interesting gender theory that they referenced.
Right.
So all that
stuff earlier we mentioned that we could not possibly explore today.
Yeah.
There's a lot of gender theory in there.
Weird.
People have a lot of thoughts.
It's just that people do have a lot of thoughts, Joe. That's accurate.
But we should define it. So what is postgenderism? Essentially, postgenderism is a movement that predicts or advocates. So you could think of it just as like, I'm saying this is most likely to happen, or you could think of it as saying, I think this is what should happen.
Mm-hmm.
But either way, it either predicts or advocates the voluntary erosion or elimination of gender distinctions in human beings or their descendants. And it's associated with transhumanism. Now, we've talked about transhumanism on the show before, but real quick refresher, it's essentially the movement advocating technology that fundamentally changes capabilities of the human animal, mentally and or physically. So if you want to become a cyborg with huge, powerful robot arms and claws on the end of them.
Clamps.
And yes, clamps, powerful clamps, super
Zoidberg.
Sensitive. Yes. Super sensitive hearing, listen through the walls, see if anybody's coming to discover you with your clamps, whatever you're doing with them. you want night vision, you want to be the predator, any of that. If you want any of that stuff, or if you want, hey, upgrade to your brain. How about that? If you want to upgrade your own processing power, maybe some onboard memory implants, any of that stuff.
If you would sign up for any of these things.
You are at some level a transhumanist.
Mm-hmm.
You want to transcend or modify biologically determined aspects of your animal nature.
Wait, so do my contacts count?
Yeah, in a mild form. I think you could say that the various prostheses we have today, like glasses and hearing aids
Our
and pacemakers and stuff like that.
LASIK surgery? I mean...
Yeah?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think
we're
those
all
are...
We're a little bit more than human these days.
Our cell phones are like actually just third arms and...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's a useful end effector.
It certainly is. I think there's actually an interesting case to be made about how we come to think about certain tools that we use very often as a part of our body. But we digress.
So, different episode, yeah.
Yeah. So postgenderism applies essentially this transhumanist concept, the desire to modify and transcend our basic nature to the naturally determined distinctions of sexual dimorphism in the species, and also just to culture broadly, to gender norms that flow from them. In the words of Dvorsky and Hughes, quote, "Postgenderists argue that gender is an arbitrary and unnecessary limitation on human potential and foresee the elimination of involuntary biological and psychological gendering in the human species through the application of neurotechnology, biotechnology, and reproductive technology." So, now, if you're not like a very traditionalist person, you might be getting a little freaked out there, thinking like, wait a minute, are there armies of radical post-genderists that are going to come try to turn me into an androgynous creature while I'm asleep?
With their transhuman robot clamps.
Right. No, we should point out the fact that this is a voluntary movement. Right. So it says essentially that in the future, to whatever extent you display dimorphic sexual characteristics or gendered social behaviors, that's going to be up to you. It's not something determined for you without your consent by biology or by social expectations.
Yeah. Choice is really the operative thing here.
Consent will always be sexy.
Yes. Yes.
Yes. So even thinking about the societal expectations expanding, right? So when we're born, we're kind of put into these boxes, right? So kind of taking this idea of postgenderism and thinking about how it will play out for someone born into a postgender world. So today there are already intersex activists who are really challenging this idea about children being born intersex being pressured into picking one gender or one sex and going with it.
Yeah. And that's often been the case leading up to now. So children born intersex are often, they're either, it's chosen for them at birth, you know, well, we're going to do some kind of therapy to you to try to make you more typically male or more typically female.
And usually a surgery.
Yeah. Or they're later in life sort of encouraged to just embrace one or the other.
Right.
Right. And so according to this position, you know, why should they? Why should we put all of these expectations on a human being who may realize that that doesn't really fit them?
Yeah.
So what is really inherently wrong with having some anatomical sex characteristics that don't match what we're expected to see based on chromosomes, right? Mm-hmm. Or what's inherently wrong with some ambiguous genitalia? According to these activists, you know, if intersex people don't feel naturally inclined to embrace one half of the gender binary or the other, they shouldn't really be pressured to do so.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, the position is really seen as one of the earliest forms of fully realized post-genderism.
Yeah.
People are born not fully conforming to a typical sex profile of male or female, and it's okay if they want to stay that way or not. In these cases, the gender binary already kind of lies more or less fully vanquished.
Right.
And while it might seem unusual, for example, in America in the 20th century, there are precedents of this all over the world and in many cultures throughout history.
Right. So the intersex birth cases, I think, are one case where you're sort of already posed to be in a post-gender position. All it really requires is the changing of attitudes in that
right.
case. Like if you are an intersex person and you live in an environment where that is fine and that, you know, nobody's telling you really should be picking one, you've already in some sense become post-gender there.
Yeah.
But there are other cases where technology could play a big role in changing what options are available to people.
Oh yeah, and this isn't, it's not just future technologies. This has already been going on for a couple hundred years, honestly, because the move towards a post-gender society, I would argue, has already begun, and it started with industrialization. The stratification of our economy, you know, the creation of a middle class, and the slow but widespread inclusion of women in the workforce has changed society's roles for men and women, moving away from a strict binary.
Yeah, and I think that's very true in that work has very often been one of the main lines upon which gender distinctions and gender oppression occurred throughout history.
Sure. And the communication age, the information age, changed that even further. It's giving more people the option to balance work and childcare as they desire, which, of course, childcare being one of those, like, typically gendered kind of roles in society. Mm-hmm. Also, on the ideological end, this whole digital revolution has been wonderfully speeding the exchange of both scientific information and also personal experiences about sex and gender. And it's allowed for the creation of support communities for people outside of the gender norm who don't live in areas where such support exists, which is so critical for changing quality of life and changing people's minds eventually. And now I had a question for you guys that I just kind of wanted to toss out there. How do you guys think that communication technology is going to continue changing gender in the future?
Like not biotechnology and stuff like that, but just the computers and internet stuff we got.
Right. Yeah. Not your sexy modem, but
Well, I mean, one thing that occurred to me, I wonder what y'all think about this, is virtual gender performance. So, So already we do a lot of our social interaction online, but in the future, just imagine a future where we do even more of it. There's even less face-to-face social interaction. I mean, whatever you think about that, that might sound kind of scary, but let's say we're as comfortable with that in the future as we are with using Twitter all day on our phones right now. How much of our social interaction and public face is going to be mediated by technology, including social media, online forums, online video games, virtual worlds? If these venues end up representing a really large or even totally dominant percentage of our interactions with others, will physicality, as in, you know, the biological or physical aspects of your body, play a smaller and smaller role in how your gender traits are expressed, to whatever extent they are? So it's just like so much of our thinking about gender always ends up being about bodies. Mm-hmm. But in a space where you have no body, or your body is literally a virtual construct, does gender disappear or become less important to you as a person?
Hmm. I think also there's a really interesting trend in social media lately, that has to do with the creation of profiles and the construction of like a brand for yourself online. Like, I think that we're all being suddenly like not even encouraged, but kind of forced into like curating a brand for ourselves. And so the way that we present ourselves to the world is more careful perhaps today, like more thought out, because you can look and evaluate your own and other people's profiles and see how you want to be presenting yourself, and gender is absolutely a part of that.
Mm-hmm. You know, I would definitely say, of course, with social media and access to just information in general, that kind of levels the playing field, right? I think a lot of the conversations that we have online around gender are so interesting right now. I think about Twitter.
Yeah.
And how a lot of feminists use Twitter and talk about the inequalities, talk about their experiences, and then also maybe people who don't identify as feminists talk about their experiences too. And it's really kind of giving us an inside glimpse at how we all kind of have thought about gender all along, or have moved throughout society, maybe not knowing how people who identified a different way felt.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I wonder if these virtual environments and virtual social circles give us the ability to experiment with non-binary or non-traditional gender roles in a way that a lot of people wouldn't if it had to involve their body and face-to-face contact.
Sure.
So a person, for example, who's biologically male might not feel comfortable performing as female in person, but maybe would on the internet.
Yeah.
And I don't know how prevalent something like that is, but it's interesting that kind of venue might open up new possibilities for what people can decide they like and who they are.
Right, yeah.
I think it might be a lot more common than we think. I mean, catfish.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I laughed, but I don't know what catfish is. You have to explain.
Okay. Oh, okay. That's when someone presents as someone who they are explicitly not online. And it's usually a negative connotation in which someone is taking someone in, is trying to extort someone for money or something like that by presenting the story of this person, this in completely made up human. And it has not infrequently been used cross gender.
Oh, that makes sense to me. Hey, sudden insert that you probably weren't expecting.
Yeah, our record scratch.
Yes, our conversation with Raquel Willis here on the future of gender ended up going very long, so we are splitting it up into two episodes, and that is going to be the end of part one of the episode.
Yes.
But if you want to hear the conclusion of this discussion about the future of gender, you can join us again next time.
Yes, so we hope that you will stay tuned across time and space for that one. In the meanwhile, hey, if you guys would like to get in touch with us, we would like that too. Our email address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com. Our profile handle name on Twitter and Facebook is also fwthinking. Search around, Google us, you'll find us. We will have Raquel's contact information at the end of the second episode, although I believe off the top of my head that if you would like to find her website, it is raquelwillis.com. That is RAQUELWILLIS.com. I think I can spell. I think that's correct. So yeah, get in touch with us. We hope to hear from you. Either way, you will hear from us again very soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.